Radio Exterior de España.
English Language Service.
Hello and a warm welcome from Madrid. I'm Alison Hughes.
Our studio manager tonight is Miguel Ángel León.
Radio Exterior de España.
Catalan Regional Chief Minister Artur Mas has announced that the planned November 9 referendum on self-rule for Catalonia will not be held and will instead be replaced by an unofficial vote on the issue. The alternative he is presenting seeks to avoid direct confrontation with the government in Madrid, which is fiercely opposed to the referendum and which has succeeded in having suspended by the Constitutional Court while the justices study the legality of the case. Artur Mas called the Spanish state a real and powerful adversary because, quote, it is denying us the possibility of voting and of being consulted as a nation. The alternative he is proposing would have no legal implications, he told a press conference this morning what it would consist of. The government of Catalonia maintains the goal of holding the consultation on November 9th of this year. What does that mean? It means there will be polling station ballots and ballot boxes. While Mr. Mas's alternative has all the trappings of a referendum, it will be a survey without any legal implication. There will be no official census of voters, nor will civil servants be called upon to man the stations, all of which would have been illegal. The question on the ballot will be the same as planned for the original referendum. Do you want Catalonia to be a state? Yes or no? If the answer is yes, the next question is, do you want that state to be independent? The leader of the CIU nationalist bloc, Mas, also admitted that cracks had begun to appear in the consensus between the pro-sovereignty parties. He also put on the table the possibility of calling plebiscite elections to confirm the result of the unofficial vote. The Spanish Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, responded to Mr. Mas's declarations. If it's true that the referendum will not be held, that's excellent news. Spain is a democracy, an advanced country, and obeying the law is everyone's obligation, and even more so, those of us in government.
Responsabilidades de gobierno.
The Deputy Prime Minister, Soraya Sanz de Santa Maria, said, I think the Catalan Chief Minister has to reflect because he, his government, and his allies are in this situation precisely because they opened paths that went against the law. Before making new proposals, he should think a little.
Precisamente por abrir caminos contrarios a la ley. Antes de hacer nuevas propuestas, creo que tendría que atender a esto.
The Catalan leader also defended his proposition in Castilian Spanish.
Es una consulta anticipada a la que puede ser la definitiva.
This is a consultation prior to what could be called the definitive vote, and furthermore, it is a response to the way the Spanish state is behaving, trying to prohibit what cannot be prohibited, which is to be up to vote in a normal manner.
No se le puede impedir a nadie, que es poder votar de forma normal.
Health authorities in Spain have said that a nurse's assistant who is the first person to contract Ebola in Europe is still in serious condition, but is improving. A German hospital, meanwhile, announced that a United Nations medical worker who was infected with Ebola while working in Liberia has died in Germany. The case of the Spanish nurse's assistant, Teresa Romero, it, like that of the nurse infected in the United States, has raised serious questions about how equipped hospitals are to cope with the Ebola outbreak. Spain's Minister of Health, Social Sciences, Services and Equality, Ana Mato, has attended a special session of the Senate to defend the government's handling of the Ebola virus. She said the government made the decision to repatriate the two infected missionaries working in Liberia and Sierra Leone with the, quote, absolute conviction that there was no risk of contagion for the public or personnel in the hospital. She also defended the guidelines followed in the treatment of the two missionaries who died from the virus, despite the subsequent contagion of a nurse's aide who had contact with one of them. The opposition and much of the Spanish public have been critical of the government's handling of the crisis, and many have called for the minister's resignation. Meanwhile, the health commissioner of the Madrid regional government, Javier Rodriguez, has apologized to the nurse's aide who was infected with the Ebola virus, Teresa Romero, and her husband, Javier Limón. Mr. Rodriguez acknowledged his unfortunate statements and says he understands the letter the nurse's husband sent him yesterday, calling on him to resign. The Madrid health commissioner had sparked waves of indignation when he said Ms. Romero might have lied. And when he blamed the contagion on her behavior, Miss Romero had two contacts with one of the infected missionaries whom she treated. And finally, the deputy governor of the Bank of Spain, Fernando Restoy, has said that the state is entitled to demand reimbursement for the amounts improperly spent by the board members and executives of the Caja Madrid Savings and Loan. Some 86 people associated with the institution had been given credit cards for undeclared expenses on top of their expense account. And that's the news. North by Southwest with Nicholas Jackson is next.
Radio Exterior de España.
North by Southwest. A taste of the United Kingdom in today's Spain. On Radio Exterior, Radio Nacional de España. With the collaboration of the British Council.
To another edition of North by Southwest, where we bring you the best of culture in Spain. This is Nicholas Jackson. With us controlling the sound is José Ramón Gómez España. In today's program, we speak to British poet Roger McGough, who recently attended Hay Festival Segovia as a guest of the British Council. Hay Festival Segovia is an annual literary festival, now in its ninth edition, which features conversations, debates, concerts and art exhibitions in different venues around Segovia, a World Heritage Site. Award-winning poet, playwright, broadcaster and children's author, Roger McGough was born in Liverpool, a city with which he's maintained a lifelong relationship. He was a member of the music and poetry group The Scaffold between 1963 and 1973 and made his name as one of the so-called Liverpool poets, together with Adrian Henry and Brian Patton. Roger McGough has twice won the Signal Poetry Award and is the author of a number of plays. He's written for and presented programs on BBC Radio, including Poetry Please and Home Truths. His film work includes Kurt Mungo, BP and Me, for which he won a BAFTA award, and he won the Royal Television Society Award for his science program, The Elements. His collected poems, bringing together over 40 years of work, was published in 2003, and his live poetry album, Lively, is available on CD. We'll be hearing a few excerpts from that CD later in the program. He was awarded a British OBE for services to poetry in 1997 and more recently a CBE and was recently honoured with the Freedom of the English City of Liverpool. Roger McGough's autobiography, Said and Done, was published in 2005. His latest adult poetry collection, It Never Rains, is to be published by Penguin this November. I started by asking Roger McGough how a contemporary poet spends his time.
A typical year, for instance, would include, hopefully, some literary festivals. A big feature now, what we do, and there's a lot of writers, for which I'm very grateful, from Hay Festivals, and I travel a lot abroad. Great, thanks to the British Council, thanks to the Hay Festival, great.
I've been a great friend of those.
I just remember years ago, one of my funniest things, with the Liverpool poets, we went to Germany on tour, and they went to Cologne, and the member of the office in Cologne said to Aachen and Munich, the Liverpool poets are coming, we make some posters, please, and newspapers and so forth. So when we arrived on our first date at Aachen, and all the newspapers announced the arrival of the little poor poets. That's great. So all over Germany, people were giving us money. It was really nice. So that's been a great thing. So the part of my year would love, you know, to go something involving going abroad. And this year, means Manchester and Dubai festivals and so forth. Most of it, though, is bread and butter stuff, and this will be doing theatre readings, because you don't get much money from publishing poetry, as you know. Do you know the average writer in England, the average income per year is £8,000 to £12,000.
Quite well.
So I don't get much from the publishing, but from performing, get paid as a theatre evening. Also, I do Poetry Please and occasional voiceovers. But my day-to-day is generally involving sitting down, trying to write.
Is poetry a dying art, or is it still popular amongst younger people?
What I've noticed over the past few years is there's a great number of young people now doing poetry. I mean, there's poets like Kate Tempest, who's nearly won the Mercury Prize, and very well thought of, who was in her 20s. I'm often doing readings. I was at the Latitude Festival
the other week.
One of the poets headlining there, for which they stayed in an airstream caravans, big silver one. My wife, Miss Grace, I was running around in this Gulfstream caravan for a fortnight. And my kids were there as well, but they were camping out in the woods. But that was like a 4 days of poets, young poets. And I say young people, like Scroobius Pip, who's quite a well-known poet, got a big following. Lots of names that will...
Not the names,
but with the huge followings.
You know, we're talking about a tent
packed out 12 hours, 14 hours a day. A lot of young people. So the poetry is there, but there's an interest in it.
More than the one I had years ago.
But there's always... I've always found in my own life, because I'm in... What I do is poetry, and I go to readings, and... usually the holes are full. Some of us surround him. Of course, seems to me to be in a very good state. You know what I mean? I'm often asked by a presenter. Often asked by a presenter, you know, is poetry having a resurgence? And it always has a resurgence. It's always there. But people don't talk about it very much. But I'm quite positive. I think it's more and more poetry going on.
Is there a difference in performing styles between younger and older poets?
What is interesting, when I talk blithely and proudly about playing at festivals with young poets, and I was at the place called the Underbelly, and the Underbelly is this wonderful upturned purple cow. Huge, but it's a big tent, in fact, what it is. And you go in and there's lots of people, 500, 600 people. And I was there for an evening called Tung Fu. And Tung Fu is an outfit. Young poets, and they organise these things with music, with a jazz group. And on a regular basis, very popular, and I was there. And the same as Latitude, I was the only one reading from a book. All the young poets come on, they learn the poems off by heart, and they present them, and they perform them very well. Sometimes they may use a tablet, but I'm like a dinosaur, so there's been this huge change in how poetry is presented and how to make it appeal to young people. And I think possibly the idea of the guy standing there or the girl standing there with a book is becoming a thing of the past. But I've always liked
the book
to hide behind. And also because I always like to do new poems and, you know, I've just written them. So, you know, I can't learn them in time.
Is there enough poetry written in other languages and translated into English?
No, we don't see enough poetry from other countries translated over. Why? I don't know. We're very bad at it, I suppose, this English sense that, you know, we all speak English.
And I was in Italy last week at the Mantova Festival and meeting Italian poets. And my poems are translated into Italian, but I didn't know their best poets. And I find the same in Spain, wherever I go. I feel very ignorant about it, and, you know, I
speak schoolboy French,
and that's about the size of it. So great luck there, yeah. Then again, there's only so many meals that you can eat a day.
As we've heard, Roger McGough presents the programme Poetry Please on BBC Radio 4. How important is radio for him as a listener?
Radio's always been like the first and foremost important in my life, more than television, I think, really. It's the intimacy of
the spoken word and listening to talking or listening to
a play on the radio.
I think your imagination has to fill in the gaps. It has to fill in the visuals. And I'd like that.
And also the rhythms of it.
I find it very reassuring and far more informative.
So radio has always been part of my life.
Another generation, you see, that when I was born
during the war, there was no television, so I was in my teens, really, till we had a television, a black and white television.
So I was sort of brought up on the oral tradition, and that's continued throughout my life.
To what extent is the future of radio under threat from other media?
I don't think radio will disappear, because even for my... I have four kids. I've had four children, two are in their 40s and two are in their 20s. And the younger ones, I wouldn't say they listen to... The young one, particularly, a lot of radio yet, but they're always listening to things. They're listening to tapes and music, of course. And the older they get, they start getting into, like, 26-year-old listens to a lot of radio, Radio 4 now, you see, and that sort of thing, and Radio 6. And so some is music, but also the words and the language is part of it, and they listen to plays, and they play back things, and they play down, they stream things, and so forth and so on. I think it's just part of what they do. I think it would be wrong to think they want visuals, and they want, you know, screens and games and stuff and stuff. No, I think that's part of growing up, I think. I like to think that the quiet word in the ear will always be utmost.
So who follows poetry nowadays? What's the typical profile of listeners to Roger McGough's BBC Radio 4 programme Poetry Please?
I must say with Radio 4 that most people who listen to it and make requests tend to be women, and they tend to be of a certain age. So there's no doubt about it. I mean, and what we're always trying to do as myself as a presenter and with producers is trying to appeal to a younger audience. And to try and make it, you know, not more cool, what can you do? But we do include sometimes the occasional music item, or John Cooper Clark, the poet, Nigel Mortimer, appeal. But it's just steady going on. You're never going to get young kids. But then again, you see, in my own life as a writer, I publish with Penguin Books and adult books. I also, my next year will be two children's books, puffing and publishing their books. There's a whole generation. And I'm of that age now where, you know, I get people coming up for me to sign a book. A woman of my age will have a grandmother and her child, her grandchild will be reading my books, my poetry books. So it's an ongoing thing. And I think those younger people listen to radio, listen to tapes, and we'll go on doing it.
By Southwest.
Listening to North by Southwest on Radio Exterior, Radio Nacional de España, where we're talking to poet Roger McGough. As we've heard, Roger McGough was born in Liverpool and was part of the so-called Liverpool Poets, whose work was immortalised in the 1967 anthology The Mersey Sound. To what extent does he maintain a relationship with Liverpool?
Very strong relationship with Liverpool. They made me a freeman of the city a couple of years ago, which is very nice. I mean, I can go into any shop and help myself with anything. I can go in pubs, cafes, girls. No, I mean, I can take my sheep across the ferry, apparently. And I worked very much closely with the Liverpool Playhouse Everyman the last few years, which I'd adapted three Molière plays. I did Tartuffe, which was a success. They went on and did Misanthrope and Hypochondria. So that was very much toing and froing. And I still have relatives in Liverpool, so any excuse, I'll be up there.
Roger McGough has worked closely with musicians, most notably as part of the pop and poetry group The Scaffold in the 1960s and 70s. Does he keep up with developments in the music world?
No, I don't. I mean, to be honest with you, nor did I ever, really. I was never, even though I was in The Scaffold and responsible for some of the world's greatest hits. If only there were time, I could sing many of them. But that was great fun, but I was also the lyricist and a rather bad, ordinary singer, never a musician. So that side of me was a great part of my life, and I enjoyed it, but I was never a musician. I you know the difference. You're all in a band together, in a group. You'll be in the dressing room, and you're all talking. I met Jimi Hendrix, and you're all talking. You're all one of them. Oh, me and Jimi Hendrix, me and Elton John, who used to play, and people. And then you'll all be talking. You're all exactly the same. And someone will pick up an instrument. And someone else will pick up an instrument. And they are united, and you're outside of that. You know, suddenly realise that you're not a musician, so what are you doing there? So part of my life is always, you know, earning money and being a performer, but not really being a musician. So, no, I've never really been kept up with what's going on in the music world.
Roger McGough also writes for children. Is it difficult to create work for younger audiences?
I think of my writing when I was, my own first writing when I came out of university, I was writing poems that I thought, I wondered whether they were poems because they weren't like the poems I'd seen in some of the university magazines, and they were about local things. When I went to teach in a comprehensive school in Liverpool, St. Kevin's, I was given Palgrave's Golden Treasury. That was the textbook. And the kids just didn't respond, so I started giving them my own poems. My own poems were about football, or about grannies, or about this and other. And they loved them. They lapped them up. So I suddenly realised, maybe I'm a poet, but there's a different sort of audience there. And it wasn't a children's audience. It was just speaking to people in my family, in a way, my tribe, my, you know, my mum, my granny, and so on. They would enjoy those sort of poems. And it's always been that, that sort of thing later on. So I don't sort of think I write a child's poem or an adult poem. I just write a poem. A lot of the poems really fit on either side of it. I'll write the poem, I put it in is this a children's, is this an adult? Where does it go in the pile? And I just collect them, and eventually there's more children's than adult. That'll be a children's poem. Occasionally, with a book called Imaginary Menagerie, I thought of strange animals, mixtures of animals, like an animal called the elevator. which are crossed between an elevator, an escalator, and an alligator. And, of course, that suggested a drawing, so I used to illustrate them as well. Once you got that idea, you think, well, I'll do another one. So you then set out on writing a children's book, obviously, you know what I mean, and that sort of happens. It's a nice offset, too, against writing about the deaths of friends, and as you'd imagine, the older you get, the more elegies than there are love poems, and you go, it's very dark sometimes, and it can be very depressive, so suddenly writing about, you know, an angry pineapple or something can be fun, and a release.
A little mentioned facet of Roger McGough's career is his illustrations of his own poems.
Well, that's been a new thing. I always illustrate my books. Yeah, I'm doing more and more of that. I always did, really. I used to take my kids' books into Puffin and show the poems and be few illustrations, and they go, editors will say, yes, oh, yes, we'll publish this. Now, who should we get to illustrate it? You know, and they get proper illustrator. I'm quite right too, because I know my limitation. But I'm a sort of Spike Milligan, Don Eggley, you know, it's a sort of minimalised thing. But I do enjoy it, and that little book coming out, in fact, this month, adult book, called It Never Rains. That's just come in, that comes out in November. And that is short poems, funny poems, with, like, cartoons and surrealist sort of illustrations. I enjoy that.
After such a long and distinguished career as a poet, playwright, broadcaster and children's author, does Roger McGough have any regrets?
Never think too much about what I haven't done and what I should have been doing. You look back and why didn't I do this? Why didn't I follow that up? I enjoyed writing lyrics for musicals. I remember I was involved once in The Wind in the Willows. Yeah, in America, I actually went to Broadway, and I'd enjoy that experience, and I think I'm quite good at that. Never been sort of... it's not a thing you'd say, oh, I think I write lyrics for a musical. You know, you're invited, and it happens, and if it does, it's great. It nearly happened, but that would mean great. I enjoy that. So I've always been on the fringe of things, and I watch other people thinking who are not as good writers as me, making lots of money, doing things, but it doesn't worry me. You can't do both. You know, you've got to make choices sometimes. And there's a certain purity about poetry, I think. A lot of my friends, like the late Adrian Mitchell, was a friend, and very strong sort of conscience about what poetry is, the purity of it. And you shouldn't get too entangled with commercialism and so forth and so on. Which is true. So I never think too much about it. I just get on. Thank God I can put pen to paper and think of something funny or something that I've never thought of before.
British poet Roger McGough, ending this edition of North by Southwest on Radio Exterior, Radio Nacional de España. This program is brought to you in collaboration with the British Council, the United Kingdom's official organization for cultural relations and educational opportunities, working in 110 countries around the world. Find out more about their cultural program in Spain at www.britishcouncil.es. We're back soon with more on culture from Spain, but for now, it's goodbye from our sound technician, José Ramón Gómez España, and from me, Nicholas Jackson. We leave you with 40 Love, Missing Sock and Oxygen, three readings by Roger McGough from his own work, reproduced here with the kind permission of the author.
Middle-aged couple playing tennis. When the game ends and they go home, the will still be between them.
There's some young ones in the audience this evening, aren't there?
So I thought I'd do a few children's poems.
All right,
two children's poems.
This is called The Missing Sock. I found my sock beneath the bed. Where have you been all week, I said. Hiding away, the sock replied. Another day in your foot, and I would have died.
Bid farewell to death. I am the kiss of life.
tomorrow.
With your last gasp,
you will call my name.
Curating a new space, a radio or airspace dedicated to books, which is probably, I think both of my companions here would say, is a little bit like dedicating a program to water, which is to say central, immense, or maybe to fire, revolutionary, potentially limitless. Books are never just books, and I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by Kenan, for whom books also constitute an essential element of their nature and our human nature. Michael McCann is a freelance writer and co-founder of Desperate Literature, an independent multilingual bookstore in Madrid featuring new and used books in Spanish, English, and French. And Antonio Diaz is the co-founder of Diaz y Pons, an independent publishing company or small press. Mm-hmm. Michael, Antonio, welcome.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, I think we should just start, because this is the beginning of what I hope will be a long relationship, with introductions. Michael, why don't you start talking a little bit about the history of Desperate Literature?
We just started in May. I guess we kind of officially opened in August.
And Desperate Literature is it's a collaborative project between three people, Corey Eastwood and myself and Craig Walter. And I hope, you know, that Corey and Craig can come in here and tell their sides of the story as well. Desperate Literature is actually a bookstore that's taken over a space, a bookstore that's existed in Madrid for what we think about 15 years. It was founded, this is all sort of... these stories have been told to us by neighbors and by clients, but...
It was a famous bookstore. Petra, was it Petra? What was it called?
I think we believe that it was started as the International Bookshop.
That's right.
By a British gentleman. And then it was taken over by an American woman named Jenny, who also called it the International Bookshop. Uh-huh. And then it became Petra's. So it's gone through several different iterations and owners. And Corey had a friend who was actually singing at the Opera House, which is just down the street, because we're in near the Plaza de Opera. And he met the owner of Petra's, who was interested in moving along and passing over the ownership to someone else. And the three of us thought that we would, you know, give it a go in Madrid. Corey has two bookstores in Brooklyn, Human Relations and Book Thug Nation. And Craig has a very, very famous bookstore in Santorini in Greece called Atlantis, which just celebrated its 10-year anniversary. And so
you decided on Madrid. Campo Manis, the street, is one of my favorite streets in Madrid, from the curve and the rising hill to get to Desperate Literature.
Yeah, it's a kind of a secret passage between Opera and Plaza Santo Domingo, in a way.
Tree line, 19th century buildings, it's lovely.
Mm-hmm.
The three of you, I imagine you're all Americans, have a sense of language, certainly. Where did you get the name Desperate Literature?
The name actually comes from a novel by Roberto Bolaño, and I think maybe I won't say which novel it is in case people want to go looking for it, but for the three of us, Roberto Bolaño was, as with many Americans, an introduction to the huge world of Spanish literature written in Spanish, both in Latin America and in the peninsula. So it seemed appropriate that we take the name from this entry point into this world of literature, which just is growing and growing.
Roberto Bolaño, the Chilean first poet and then novelist and essayist, came to Spain and lived in a town outside of Barcelona until his death at the age of 54. He had a wife and children and had published The Savage Detectives, the Las Putas Asesinas collection is called, or Llamadas Telefónicas, a series of collections of short stories in Spanish, and he certainly helped reinvent Latin American literature after the boom of the 60s.
Especially for English speakers, I think, was, Spanish literature, or literature in Spanish, sort of ended with the boom, and so this was a sort of a wake-up call that there was this, you know, whole world of writers and poets that are just now starting to be translated, who are, you know, have some sort of lineage to the boom, but are inventing their own literature and things like that. So I think, and now this is open up to Javier Marías and Enrique Villamatas, and just a whole other sort of canon of writers.
And the other two that you mentioned are both Spaniards. It is exciting. So the listeners may look for desperate literature in one of Bolaño's works. What does it refer to, though? What is desperate literature? What do you feel it is, apart from the reference to a beloved author?
I think, and I would probably, you know, each of the owners of the poet has different answers to that, so it'd be interesting to hear the others. But, I think of it as literature when you're sort of desperate, and that in literature you can find meaning in a sort of the sometimes seemingly meaningless existence that we have, you know, and...
So in one sense, it would be a cure to desperation.
Yeah.
Or if you're for desperation.
Or you can look, you know, it's how other people have sort of taken this desperation, expressed it in a way. Bolaño's writing is definitely an example of this.
What kind of books do you sell?
We sell all kinds of books. Our focus is used books, although we do have some... We have some new books, basically, so we can have some of our favorite authors in translation. But we sell books. We sell poetry. We sell books about travel, essays. We're really fond of noir, the novela negra.
And of selling them in the three languages.
Yeah, we sell them primarily in English, Spanish, and French, but we also have books in Italian and German and... Very few in Russian and Catalan and Hebrew. But the main three are Spanish, French, and English, yeah.
Now, did you or your partner Corey or Craig have any prior relationship to Madrid?
Craig actually has spent some time here, and he had a friend who had worked at Petra's beforehand, and he had come to Madrid to buy Spanish books for Santorini, to sell in Santorini. So he had more of a... I think he had the most relationship out of all of us. I've been here very briefly.
And how did you meet your other two partners in this venture?
Corey has been a friend of mine for 10 years. We met in New York, and I met Craig through Corey, through maybe what you'd say like an international network of booksellers.
Well, I'm going to ask you much more about bookselling, but I'm going to turn to another bookseller in a different sense, Antonio Diaz. I noticed that in Desperate Literature, in Michael's bookshop, they're selling new books by small presses, beautiful editions, and among them are editions from the collections of Diaz and Pons. Mm-hmm. So could you, Antonio, tell us a little bit about the history of Diaz and Pons? How long has this small press existed?
Well, Diaz and Pons is a publishing house, an independent publishing house, that was founded at the end of 2012. That's 2 years ago, and was created by two friends, two old friends, Pedro Pons and Antonio Diaz. We know each other since we were 15, maybe 14, and we had this dream of creating a publishing house where we could publish those interesting books in essay, where you could find not only truth, but another ways of expressing and representing the world. We were talking some days ago, about the relationship between Ortega y Gasset and Maria Zambrano.
Uh-huh. Two major figures in Spanish thought.
Mm-hmm. And the first one thought that in Spain, as we hadn't the tradition of enlightenment, we don't have a tradition of knowledge. But Maria Zambrano said that we had a lot of knowledge in Spain, but in a poetic way. That's the poetic reason of Maria Zambrano. And when we created the Zampons, we thought that we would like to pull these essay books, but not only about truths or books written in an explicit way, but essay books that are written in a poetic way. And well, for now we have two collections, two series. We have the first one is about politics, small books, brief books, but very useful for specific subjects. Modelos para armar.
Which refers to the models that we mm-hmm. make with the little pieces.
And also to the book of Julio Cortázar.
The models that came out of Rayuela, that came out mm-hmm. of Hopscotch. Mm-hmm. And that refers to the more rationally based mm-hmm. essays.
We think that books are useful. We need books. And we need books as tools, as detonators of ideas. That's why we like small books. Books that you can lend, you can buy because they are very cheap, you can read fast, and you can use their ideas to critique themselves, of course, and to argue with other people. There are books for talking. We have another series, it's about art. We have published, for example, a book about Elsa Manfred and Loringhoven, who was the girlfriend of Lucian, wasn't exactly the girlfriend, but they had a relationship. It's very interesting because the ready-made was created not only by Lucian, but comes of this relationship between them.
What is her name? Trump's friend?
Elsa von Freital-Loringhoven. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For now, we are involved in these two series. I have to say that it's a crazy idea to become a publisher. I don't recommend to anyone, but it's so fun. And you have to be passionate with that. But if you have this passionate thing, you have this problem, it's a problem to be crazy with books, you are going to have a lot of fun, and it's really interesting. It's very hard now.
Well, this is, you're giving rise to sort of an uncouth question, but in this day and age and in this country at this moment, how are you two able to make ends meet in such, as you said, a passion-driven profession mm-hmm. as book publishing or book selling? How are you able to live?
I think we are different sides of the same problem, but our positions reveal a lot of things about the situation in Spain. I can speak mainly about my position as a publisher, as an independent publisher. When I say that to become a publisher now is a problem, I'm joking, of course, but it's not easy. We are in a very difficult moment, not for books, but for culture. Things are changing. The welfare state is in crisis. And one of the things that have this big crisis is the culture. So government doesn't help. We have a big problem about reading in Spain. We lose this tradition of reading, not for buying books or reading, but we can talk about the economic crisis, about the way we're losing this tradition of reading. But also, I think that there are many people that are passionate, that are creating newspapers, magazines, printing houses, many projects about culture.
Isn't it also, like you said, about the small books? Like, when big cultural institutions are faltering and culture in total is struggling, then these small books are something that kind of keep people going and become a network in which someone can read something and pass that book along in a way, which I think is one of their strengths that continues on even when there's, you know, economic or cultural crises.
Antonio Diaz of Diaz y Pons Editores and Michael McCarron, freelance writer and co-owner of Desperate Literature, an international new and used bookstore in Madrid, situated on Calle Campomanes 13. Talk about books and their work. Antonio, you said you publish books for talking, to inspire conversation. What sort of criteria do you have when you're making your selection?
Our way of working in Modelos para Hablar is very simple. Pedro Pons and me, we are the editors, and we have a series director for this series. He's Daniel Marias. He's a specialist in geographics in the Universidad Carlos III de Madrid. And I'm very proud of our method because it's very informal. We are talking every time. We don't have this bureaucratic way of working of big policy houses. Maybe we are having a coffee, or maybe we are having a conversation, or maybe we are talking with someone. We like to flow. We like to let it flow. And we don't have a rigid method. We like to publish a specialist. In each book is about one area, very important for contemporary society. And we like to choose the specialists for each area, but not only university teachers or academics, but people who, for some reason, dedicated his life to this subject, to this area of knowledge. And for example, one author I'm very proud of publishing is José Manuel Naredo. He is the professor in economics between economics and ecology, but he also was one of the editors of Ruedo Ibérico. The publishing house was based whose objective was to left books in Spain in the Franquism. And that's very interesting.
Books that would otherwise have been prohibited, that were prohibited. Mm-hmm. This author had been involved with that.
He was the editor of Cuadernos de Ruedo Ibérico, was the series of politics that was published by Ruedo Ibérico. And he's not an academic, but all his life he has been involved in not only in politics, but in intellectual debates and this way of living the edition, talking, arguing, and disagreeing.
A public intellectual, one of the last, maybe.
And your criteria for the books that you sell? How did you get the collections of Diaz y Pons, for example?
Well, and maybe this is to do with this, you know, what comes out of crisis of culture and you know, markets is that people, that there's openings for relationships between small publishers and bookstores. So, you know, I just met Antonio through some of the, there's some other publishers here and the sort of social network around them. And we were really happy to carry the books, to be able to have a sort of personal relationship with a publisher who's making these small, beautiful books with really important topics. I hope that, you know, we can translate some of them into English at some point.
I like to remember how we met in the bookstore when we began talking. And that was because you had a book published by Elias in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I think was Hotel Palenque by Robert Smithson.
Right.
And I realized that someone there has something to do with contemporary art.
Right, right. We have a series of books from Alias Press, which I think they're based in Mexico, but they have distribution in the United States. And they, maybe in a similar form, try to bring contemporary art and theory to Mexico, translating it into Spanish, usually from English. And this book, Hotel Palenque, is really, really beautiful. And I met them because I worked in the art world before working in the...
I think both of you have worked in the art world, is that right? In fact, you didn't start in bookselling or in book publishing. You started in galleries. What was your role in...
I think I've always moved in between the border of these two. So I've worked in bookstores, and I worked in galleries, and I've worked in galleries that were bookstores, and bookstores that were also galleries. Mm-hmm. And so it's always been an interest of mine how the art world and the literary world interact. And it's been interesting over the years to see that this interaction is becoming more, I don't know, more intense or, you know, more widespread. The art world seems to be more interested in literature, in books, in poetry, and vice versa. People who writers and publishers are sort of looking at contemporary art and the models of contemporary art and seeing like how these two things can go together, maybe to create new forms and new readerships and new audiences. And so this is something that we had a lot to talk about, I guess.
That's a big conversation between us, because, well, I work in contemporary art world as well, and I worked in museums, and I was a specialist in contemporary art in an auction house. And I like to say that because it sounds very weird and strange, a very specialized world. And it was really interesting, because one of the functions, one of the roles of the specialist in an auction house is to find artworks in very strange places. And, well, I had lots of fun, and it's one of the places where I learned all what I know. And I think we share this conversation about how we need in this society to spread the culture, because sometimes the contemporary art world have a problem for me, and it is that its social impact is very low. But if you're a publisher, ideas can spread better. That's very interesting.
It's interesting, too, because books can kind of ride that line between an artwork and, you know, and something that diffuses ideas in a way. So that's, for me, that's interesting. When I worked in the art world, we dealt a lot with books as art objects. But for me, it's more interesting when they're sort of diffusing ideas, spreading ideas in this way that you're talking about, and maybe like decentralizing these concepts or maybe these theories. And in a way, I guess they also are artwork, pieces of art that can pass from hand to hand.
Do you think books as objects, now that so many other media predominate in society, do you think books as the physical object have become more important or less?
I think maybe there's two ways that books have become more important since the rise of digital media. I think on one hand, there is a move to collect books as these fetishized commodities. And I definitely, that's, you know, in one of my previous jobs, that's what we did. And so we'd spend a lot of
time. What did you do?
It'd be like buying the archives and papers of writers, of important artists. And so out of this would be drawing objects that were unique or valuable because of the ownership. So because someone famous owned this book and maybe wrote an inscription in it is what made it sort of unique and extremely valuable. So I think there's a move to do that, as, you know, as you can imagine, the papers of writers in the future they won't have letters, they won't have... I mean, they might. I hope they will still have journals, you know. But that part of the sort of the book world is not so interesting to me. But I think what's more interesting is that people, and maybe younger generations, seem to be interested in books as objects, printed books. I feel like there's a huge move to found independent publishers, independent presses, small publishing houses. People are making their own books and distributing their own books. And I imagine that's because, you know, as a sort of a reaction to the saturation of our world with like digital media and the internet.
Michael McCann of Desperate Literature Bookstore in Madrid and Antonio Díaz of Díaz y Pons Editores with me at the studio of Radio Exterior de España. Both of you went into these respective businesses thinking that you would be able to survive financially from them. You went in with a certain faith.
Yeah, I think there's a faith. I mean, I don't want to speak for my partners, but their bookstores are doing well. They're doing better than they have when they started. And so, I don't know, it speaks to this kind of continuation of books. And I'm really fond of this. I have an essay by Ursula Le Guin. I'm also fond of most of her writing. But she wrote an essay for Harper's I think the subtitle is on the supposed decline in readership. And her argument, which I think is really interesting, is that books and reading books has always been sort of, you know, a smaller percentage of the population. And that it's only this period from 1850 to 1950 when it became a mass market, a mass medium. And that's where we get these huge publishing houses who see books as products, you know, products to make money. And that when people say that readership is going down or that books aren't going to be relevant, what they're talking about is the decline of this industry, this way of making lots and lots of money out of books. And I think what's coming in its place is the rise of the book as a medium of spreading information, of learning, of experiencing other worlds and existences. And I think there will always be an interest in that.
In my opinion, I would like to add that as a publisher, we have in Spain a golden age of publishing. For publishing, we only have one word in Spain. It's to be an editor. But in English, you have two words, to publish or to edit. So what we had in Spain last 30 years was publishing houses, very big publishing houses. It's all about marketing, all about market industry. And we lose all the editors, the independent editors. And what is happening now is that all the big publishing houses are falling down and small independent editors are growing. And that's very beautiful.
It's happening in the United States as well. Not only the large publishing houses have collapsed, but also the sort of monster booksellers like Barnes & Noble. But it gives rise to all these sort of independent publishers and independent booksellers actually as well.
In Spain, it's happening as well with booksellers. So independent bookstores are growing as well. And you're an example. Desperate Literature is an example of that situation. And I think it's very positive.
Well, I see that your bookstore is not just a place to buy books, but it's also designed as a meeting place. You organize other activities, and the three owners, the three of you, have another vision as well. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I think for us, independent bookstore, a secondhand bookstore, is always it has a dual function. It's a place to find books, of course, but it's also a place to exchange culture, to talk about books, to meet people who are interested in books and literature, you know, in a way that maybe other retail spaces are not, because you're coming and you're looking for ideas and experiences, and maybe in our case, you know, it's you're looking to find a new language to sort of to not only cross over into another world, but like another language altogether. And yeah, and we host small gatherings. We're a small bookstore, and readings, and we've had a concert so far.
It's funny, two of the times that I was there, young Spanish families who were looking for books in English for a child. One was a 12-year-old, I think, and, mm-hmm. and I remember it was either you, Michael, or you, Antonio, who helped them find an appropriate book in English for the 12-year-old Spaniard. So there are many also very interesting intercultural encounters.
I feel like, as I said, there's a enormous interest in Spanish literature for the English-speaking world, but I also feel that in Spain there's a exponentially growing interest in especially English, but other European languages as Europe becomes more integrated and the borders are open and people move from here to England, to France, to Italy. And a lot of that mobility is based on language, now that the sort of legal restrictions have been removed.
And you publish only in Spanish?
Yes.
But you distribute in Latin America as well as Spain?
We have, for now, distribution in Spain, and we are dealing with the distribution in Latin America because it's a very complex... Latin America is not one place. There are many countries. And now we have a little distribution in Latin America, but we are growing. That is 2 years. Oh. 2 years only.
2 years and how many books?
12.
That's a lot for 2 years. Now, I received an announcement in my email today Tensión Cultural, Music, Words, and Alcohol, an event that will be taking place on this week in Desperate Literature.
That's right.
What is this going to be, Michael?
This is, we're going to have an event this Friday. It's, again, like most of our events so far, is pretty informal, maybe a bit like a salon. And it's a collaboration with a group of people who run a music night called Tensión Ritual. And so we'll just have some people reading their work in Spanish and in English, and then a musician from the United States is going to play some music, and we'll serve drinks, of course, because books and drinks always go very well together.
They do indeed. Thank you so much, and I look forward to attending the event, and I also very much look forward to, perhaps by phone, but meeting your partners, Corey and Craig, and having you both here together again in the studios.
I do too.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You've just heard the English language service of Radio Exterior de España. From Monday to Friday, we broadcast to Europe and Africa from 19 hours to 20 hours UTC. Our Saturday and Sunday broadcasts to Europe begin at 21 hours UTC. Our European broadcast goes out on 9665 kilohertz in the 31-meter band from Monday to Friday, and on 9660 kilohertz in the 31-meter band on Saturdays and Sundays, while our African broadcast goes out from Monday to Friday. 11 are always welcome. Spanish National Radio broadcasts in English, P.O. Box 156202, Madrid 28080, Spain. Or write us at our email address, English@rtve.es.